Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Finally wired up, I guess. The March 22nd, 2022 HRSD Commission meeting will now come to order. We will now have a roll call of the HRSD Commission members. Please say here, or Ms. Casio calls your name.
Blunt.
Here.
Lockawalla.
Yes.
Levinston.
Here.
Stern.
Here.
Taroski.
Here.
Rodriguez.
Here.
Eliason.
Here.
Commissioner Templeman is not attending today.
Okay. Thank you for the roll call. I understand there are several members of the public participating virtually today. Thank you for your interest in observing the meeting. And a few reminders, please. Please keep your microphone on mute when not speaking. The audio of the meeting is being recorded for posting on our website. Before speaking, please first state your name. Ms. Casio will call commissioner names for a roll call vote on each agenda item requiring action. Only public comments pre-registered with Ms. Casio will be accepted during the call. I understand we have one person registered to make public comments today.
No, we do not.
Okay, so that person disappeared. All right. From there, we go to awards and recognitions with a new general manager leading us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. What a beautiful Tuesday to have a commission meeting. So definitely going to get things started off right with a couple of awards. These are for the Providence Road Offline Storage Tank and Woodstock Park Improvements Project. And this is that one where we've got this wet weather storage tank with a skate park on top. The first award is by the American Council of Civil Engineering Companies for their grand award, and that's a State of Virginia award. And the second one is a Build America Merit Award. This is a contractor's award, and this was a national award. Is there anything you want to mention, Chris?
So I was on the awards committee for the first award, so I had to abstain from voting on that award, but these are both great awards. One's on the consulting side and one's on the contracting side. And this was a design build project. So it was a great initiative and it's just a great project. And it's getting a lot of acclamations. And I think there'll probably some other awards in our future on this project.
Yeah, really good example of working with our locality to accomplish new goals.
That's what I noticed attended the ceremony that we had. And it was a good marriage of three or four major organizations, government and private business, all coming together to make this project work. And then the kids who came on right after the ceremony and went way to town doing all their flips and whatever.
Well, speaking of that, we've got that video, oh, and you might see a familiar face on that video as well. So,
everybody, what a magnificent day. I'll tell you what, this is a blast to be here. Now, I've been known to do a couple hundred of ribbon cuttings and things, but this is by far the biggest wow factor that I have seen. And let's give a hand to the collaboration between the city with Parks and Rec and HRSD. Let's hear it.
Well, this park opening will have a tremendous impact on our youth and families. First of all, we have new shelters, new playgrounds, we got tennis courts, pickleball courts, lots of things to do. But of course, the coup de grace is the 30,000 square foot skate park here, which will just have an amazing impact on our skateboarding community.
The park is amazing. It's got everything you could want. We've got a big flow bowl, a big deep bowl, whole street course, little tech Manny section up at the top. It's got everything.
This park is huge. There's lots of space. There's lots of new stuff. I started skating about like 2 years ago, but I can tell this park is going to make me the best skater ever.
Well, this was designed so it was inclusive for both skateboarders, BMX bikers, the inline skaters, and the two-wheel scooters, so that everybody had an activity they could do and there was plenty of room to accommodate a whole lot of skaters to do it.
This partnership occurred about 4 years ago. HRSD came to us with a proposal where they needed to solve a complex problem, and based on their regional needs for wet weather storage tank, The location at Woodstock Park was prime for them. The innovation is what makes this project really exciting. The partnership with a wastewater utility and Parks and Recreation is not a likely partnership you see every day. So we took that and was able to provide that innovation with putting the skate park on top of the wastewater tank.
Complexity of this is we're on a 5.2 million gallon storage tank, and some of the skate components are up here, and so from an engineering standpoint, getting everything to mesh and connect together was a large undertaking.
When you come and roll up to the park, you still feel like you're in a park. You almost have no idea of what's happening underneath this tank or that there even is a tank here, and that's the beauty of it.
A 30,000 square foot skate park. Think about it. Look at the fun these folks are having right now.
I like this park a lot because there's like different assets to it. You can never really get bored here. Like you always have something to skate. I like the freedom. Like, I mean, you can never be too good. Like you can always get better and like progress your skating as much as you can.
If I had to describe the skate park in one word, it would be incredible because it just has everything you want.
This park actually is gonna bring everyone from all different types of parks. I see people that usually at Northside that stay there, they're gonna bring them here. People from Chesapeake are gonna come here. All types of skaters, transition, flat ground, they're all gonna learn new tricks. Everyone's gonna be here together. It's gonna be awesome.
The skateboarding community, it's great. It's all friendship. It doesn't matter who you are, what race you are, how old, young you are. It's all a family, and we get together and do this just for the love of the sport. And you can express yourself however you want. There's no rules or regulations, you're just free to express yourself.
One of the great things about Virginia Beach is its skateboarding community. And I was amazed during the development of this project, all of the different types and ages of people that showed up for the input. We have little children out here right now, they're probably 5 or 6 years old, biking around, up to older adults. Just the entire breadth of our population uses these amenities and uses them every day throughout the year. The skateboarding community is very active, very diverse, and we're ecstatic to have this built for them.
I've met like teenagers like my age, I've met little kids, older people, like just, it's all a really tight community. So everybody just looks out for each other and it's really cool.
All right, looks like there's still hope for me when I retire.
Right, like Harper, an econ major who piles on the pressure. Grammarly can help her stress.
Okay. Well, I think the collaboration of all of the various entities coming together to make that a success story. It's a good one. All right. Any other awards?
No.
Okay. And we move on to the consent agenda.
So on the consent agenda, I'm not aware of any items that need to be pulled or any questions on any items, but I did want to highlight one item. That's the sodium hydroxide blanket purchase agreement, you know, to be on the consent agenda for a $9.3 million item. It's kind of big, right? But what ended up happening is we had a 60% increase in unit cost for sodium hydroxide, and that's something we use for odor control and nitrification for pH control. And that's with a 25% decrease in usage. So this is really going to be a storyline when we talk about the budget later. Some of the numbers you're going to see are kind of like these crazy year-over-year cost increases. So that's why I really wanted to highlight this one, also because it's a big number as well.
Is it a shortage of materials? Is it a byline issue? Is it
all? And if you think about foundationally how, you know, some of these chemicals are made, you need fuel and power, and those costs are going up. And so you're starting to see things kind of like bubble up, you know. And that, like I said, it's gonna be a great segue to when you see some of the cost increases in our budget later.
All right, so need a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Thank you.
All in favor say yes. Those against say no. By roll call.
Flynn?
Yes.
Bakdawala?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Stern?
Yes.
Taroski?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Elison?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Item three.
Item three, this is the Eastern Shore Infrastructure Improvements Transmission Force Main Phase One. We've got two recommended actions today: appropriate additional funding in the amount of $8,874,611, and approve a stipulated price of $22,961,728 to the comprehensive agreement with Barney and Companies. And as you know, this is the big project for Eastern Shore. And there's lots of facets to it. And so as such, I've asked Dr. Bruce Husselby to brief us on this.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good to see everyone. Good to see everyone in person.
Yes.
So, as Jay mentioned, this is one of our most important projects, and it's a project that we're really trying to move quickly for a number of reasons. I'll mention some of those today. So this is really a fast track project. We're using the design build delivery method, just like we did with the Woodstock Park project. And there's a lot of analogies you can use to describe something that you're trying to do quickly, but the one I like the best is, you know, we're really trying to fix the airplane while we're in mid-flight. So we're making course corrections, we're doing things as the project's being designed and built. So, and that kind of delivery method kind of lends itself to that. Jump to the next slide, please. So here's a quick outline of what I wanted to cover this morning. Talk a little bit about the project, kind of a high level overview. As Jay said, there's a lot of facets to it. Talk a little bit about the delivery and kind of the status where we are with the project specifically. We've had some changes in scope to the project since we first started it. It began we hired the design build team last July. And so it's about 8 months since then. We've had a number of changes since then. Some of the towns and counties on the Eastern Shore, you know, we're kind of moving quickly and they're trying to run with us. So we got a lot of folks all working together here. There's been some budget impacts, and Jay mentioned those. Talk a little about the schedule. And then we've got a lot of property acquisition efforts that are underway simultaneously with this. You know, in a perfect project, you get all the issues figured out first, then you design it and build it. But in this project and in a lot of the projects we do, we don't have that luxury of having all the answers before we get going here. So a lot of the acquisition status is underway. And if you remember what we did in Surrey, that project was a long pipeline project with lots of property acquisitions and lots of issues. Take Surrey and just move to the Eastern Shore. Pretty much that's what we're doing with this project. And then I'll give you some recommendations at the end. So here's kind of just an overview image of work on the Eastern Shore. You know, I'm like probably most of you all, I drive up the Eastern Shore and I just kind of keep going. I stayed in Cape Charles and done a few things there. But other than that, I'm heading north and keep going. Well, we're getting to learn a lot more about the Eastern Shore as this project's unfolding here. So generally, it's a long 20-mile high-density polyethylene pipeline. It begins at the south end down in Massawattocks, and it heads north up to the town of Onancock, where there's the existing treatment plant that we're now operating and running. There's extra capacity at that location, so we can build this pipeline, take some of the facilities offline, and kind of solve a number of problems for the Eastern Shore.
What's the size of that line?
It varies in size. Originally, it was going to be kind of a nominal 6-inch diameter up to a certain point, and then it was going to be about an 8-inch, 10-inch. Now it's going to be 4-inch from Massawattocks to Wachaprigue, and then to Exmoor, and then heading north, it's 10 to 12 inch in diameter. And that's actually been some of the changes too.
And are they following 13? Is it?
Generally along 13, we're in the railroad right of way, okay. The abandoned railroad right of way with a lot of the pipeline. So that's saving us on some construction costs. We're still negotiating with the Canoni folks to get that agreement finalized. I think we're getting real close there, but yeah, generally there.
Thanks.
In addition to the 20-mile plus pipeline, we've got three pump stations that we're building, and we're going to be serving, when we're done here, Massawattocks, Exmoor, Wachaprigue, and portions of Melfa. There's an industrial park there that'll tie into this transmission force main. So a lot of the development there. And as I said, there's two treatment plants coming offline. Massawattocks will come offline that we're currently owning and operating. And then Exmoor has a treatment plant, and that'll be able to come offline when this project's done. So they have grand plans in Exmoor too, and they've got a lot of things that they're doing kind of simultaneously as we are.
Bruce, real quickly.
Yeah.
So will this allow for additional development in those cities or towns?
Yes, some nominal amount. Not tons of development. But yeah, there's some capacity in this line. We can add more pump stations to get additional hydraulic capacity in this line. But yes, the growth is slow over there. But yeah, there is some growth and they have some plans, but mainly it's a transmission force main picking up existing towns and existing development. Mm-hmm. But there will be some growth, I'm sure, as a result of this project.
Now, the hospital will benefit from this. The new hospital, Riverside Hospital. Didn't we one time?
The hospital has a lot of staff.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
If we work with them, I'm trying to talk to somebody on the hospital that we were working in conjunction with when they were trying to get easements.
So I can't hear exactly. This is Charles. Good morning. The new hospital is already served by the Nancock treatment plant. So it's already connected. The old hospital, well, there's nothing associated with the old hospital anymore, but the businesses surrounding the old hospital are served by the existing quite old Nassauwatuck's treatment plant. That treatment plant will come offline and be a pump station. So those businesses in Nassauwatuck's would be served eventually by Nancock. I couldn't hear everything. I hope that answers the question.
It does. Thank you, sir.
So there will be another plant still over there functioning.
There's the Nancock plant will remain. Yes, sir.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a number of smaller plants that we're not, you know, involved with at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe in the future. And we're studying some of those things. So we're project delivery status. You know, we're using a design build delivery method to deliver the project. AECOM and Garney is the design build team. Garney were the folks that we talked to last month. They were awarded the Nansman project design build. They're a good national firm. They're actually the ones that protested that bid on the Hampton I&J project, if you recall too. But a good company, and they've done a great job with it so far. So, you know, how we do the design build delivery method, we hire a design build team, and we did that last July, and we have a conceptual design, a 30% design, and they give us a price for that conceptual design. And then we proceed that design to about a 60 to 70% level, and then we get a final stipulated price. And that's the point where we're sitting at today. And if there's been any changes in scope since we did the original price proposal, then we consider those changes. And 9 times out of 10, those changes are things that we add. These aren't things that the contractor had. These were scope changes that we've added as the projects kind of move forward. You know, the devil's in the details, right? So we're getting into the details. And obviously the folks on the Eastern Shore are realizing we're very serious about this project. So everybody's kind of jumping on the bandwagon here and we're moving forward. So it kind of forces everybody to make decisions and move the project forward. So we got that price proposal back in July of 2021. We call that a contract cost limit. And we have a conceptual design that we prepared that's called our basis of design report, which they based that original price on. They're at the 60% design level now. That's what price we're talking about today. If we award this to them and we plan to, then they'll continue with that final design and start construction simultaneously. And that's where you see some savings on the schedule, because you can start building. You don't need to have all the answers to start building on some of the construction effort. So that's one of the beauties of this delivery method. But as you might guess, we got a price from them last July, and the economy's been a little crazy since then. So there's a lot of risk for a design build team to give a price in this environment, particularly, you know, on a normal project, we get a price right before they're going to start construction. So they're only holding that price for maybe a month or two, or maybe less than that, where they can sign their purchase orders. Well, they gave us a price last July, and they couldn't sign purchase orders with the various material suppliers and such until after this meeting, because we didn't award the construction contract until after this. So they've had to hold that price for quite a while. So that's a very challenging situation in this economy. Before this, it wasn't nearly as bad because prices were pretty level and everyone kind of knew what the game was, and they could put a small contingency in for price risk. But in this environment, it's a little tougher. So that's one of the beauties of this delivery method. We love it as the owner because it gives us early cost certainty. But for the design build team, that's a lot of risk that they're taking on. And if we're not careful about that risk, they're going to price that risk and we're going to pay for it. So we've tried to do some things on this project and others to kind of balance those things so that we're not taking excess risk, or we're not putting the contractors in a dangerous situation where they're going to lose their shirt. On the other hand, we don't want them to put some huge escalation factor on our projects. So it's all this balancing act is what we're trying to achieve in this project. So this is an image that shows kind of the project. There is a portion to the north there that's north of Accomack that runs up to, north of Nancock towards Accomack. We're not building that as part of this project. And there is a small section of line that runs out towards Watcha Creek that's not on this image either. But generally this shows you what we're planning on building. So we've had at least 5 changes in scope, and we've had some pluses and minuses as the projects move forward, but mostly they're on the plus side. So we've made improvements to the sewer system in Accomack County. We're about ready to take over the Accomack County collection system. So we wanted to make some improvements to that because we're going to tie in this new transmission force main to that system. So since we knew we were taking it over anyway, we looked at the condition of some of those assets. They needed some improvements. We were going to tie into it anyway. Just made sense to make some improvements to the Accomack system currently. In addition to that, Exmoor, as we had an initial plan from Exmoor, they were going to close their treatment plant, and we were going to connect just that treatment plant into the new transmission force main. Well, they've used this project as an opportunity to tie in the entire town of Exmoor. They're putting in a series of grinder pumps out there, so almost the entire town will come into this transmission force main. That's more flow, that's more capacity. We've had to upgrade the pump station and the downstream system to accommodate that. There's definitely time to do it. This is the time to get it right. And Exmoor has gotten some money to do some of these things. We've had to make some improvements to the Hartman Avenue pump station in Nancock. We'll talk about that. There's some improvements also to Jackson Street in Nancock that we're going to do. And we've changed the tie-in point, the transmission force main, which has some benefits to the whole community. But there was some extra costs associated with that. And I'll run through some of these things specifically. So we're in the process of taking over both the Accomack County collection gravity sewer collection system and the Onantuck gravity sewer collection system. When we're done, we'll own those two collection systems. We'll have the transmission force main, and we'll own the treatment plant. So that effort is underway. But to do that, we've had to make some improvements to what we originally planned with the transmission force main. We've added some valves. There's about 6 manholes. There's some rehab work we're doing in the gravity sewer, primarily in the town of Onley. Thanks. And there's an existing pump station we have to make improvements to in Accomack County there. So those are all necessary improvements that we just kind of proactively said, let's just do this now. We've got a contractor in the area. We're going to own the system anyway. Let's just get this in this project. So we've added that. In the town of Exmoor, as I mentioned, we originally had a relatively small pump station planned. It's slightly larger now. It's still, for the pump stations that we build, it's all small submersible pump station with a small prefab building, but it's larger than we originally planned. And the transmission force main downstream of the Exmoor tie-in point had to be larger to accommodate these increases in flow. So, and we're putting in a flow meter. We're actually wholesaling our service to Exmoor. We're not going to own their collection system, which is kind of unusual for us, but we're going to be a wholesaler to them. They'll just, whatever the flow meter says at the end of the month is what Exmoor is going to owe HRSD. So kind of unusual situation there, but that was the deal made with HRSD and our previous gentleman. And then in addition to that, we tie in upstream of the Hartman Avenue pump station, which is in Onancock. So that pump station will have to pump more flow towards the Onancock treatment plant. You can see that little triangular area is the existing pump station. And this is our new pump station site. So it's still a relatively small pump station for us. A lot of it's below ground. It's a submersible pump station with submersible pumps. There'll be a small above ground building. But we needed to increase the capacity and kind of bring it to our standards. So that pump station was too small to handle the increase in flow, and it was outdated and needed an upgrade. And we're going to own this system in the future anyway, so we kind of just bit the bullet and said, let's make these improvements now while we're at it. And then in addition, we've made a deal with the town to make some improvements to a section of Jackson Street. This originally we were going down Jackson Street. This is a street that you kind of see from this image here. It's kind of an older street. It needs some work. We were going to tear it up anyway with our new pipeline. Now we're not going to tear it up with our new pipeline. We had already made commitments to the town to make all these improvements to the street. They had already made commitments to the residents. And now we aren't going down this street, but we had already committed to make improvements to the street. And we had already kind of put it out to the world. So we're going to continue with these improvements on Jackson Street, and Ted had made that arrangement with the town manager. And I think it's just hard for us to take that back at this point. We made those agreements with the town, and everybody had that expectation. I believe the town is going to turn this section of road over to VDOT when they're done. So there was a lot of things that had happened with the plan, original plan of tearing up the street and making these improvements. We've just decided to continue with that agreement and make these improvements on Jackson Street. And we're making other improvements. We're doing other roadway work in the areas that we are tearing up. So we're going to have a contractor out there to make those improvements, but we're going to take on this responsibility as part of this project.
What's the cost of this?
That's about $500,000 improvement. We're pretty much tearing up the road from curb to curb, sidewalk, redoing the base course, doing the whole thing. Now, we originally were going to tear it up anyway, but now it's just, that was the deal that we made. We're tearing up. The Eastern Shore is going to have quite a mess for quite a while for this project. We're kind of minimizing it. We're going down the railroad right away. We're doing everything we can to minimize the impacts. There's going to be a lot of impacts to the citizens and on the Eastern Shore with this project. So it's the arrangement that was made. So as I said before, we've got a different tie-in point. That solid green line is showing the new tie-in point for the transmission force main system. That dashed line that you can see to the kind of the left-hand side of the drawing there is the old alignment. Thanks for that. The good thing about the new tie-in point, it's a shorter length. There's less easements required, and there'll be generally less disruptions to the citizens, but it does require us to make improvements, as I mentioned, to the Accomack County system. Those are improvements we were very likely going to be making anyway. So we're kind of, it's kind of a trade-off at this point, but it's going to be better, I think, in the long run that we tie in this location of the transmission force main, that dark green line where we're planning. We had to make some other minor improvements in that area, add some other features, but it's generally the best long-term solution. So budget impact, we haven't had a budget of $17.6 million previous to this effort. We need $8.8 million to make the additional scope changes that we've talked about. That'll put us at a budget of $26.5 million. This is the number that's in our CIP. We can afford to make these additional costs. One of the interesting aspects, there's a dollar value in the agenda item, which is $1.9 million that we're paying off a loan for a Nancox treatment plant. But the VRA is going to give us that money back in debt forgiveness, but we have to front that money. So that's showing up as a new cost. So really, you could argue that $8.8 million should be reduced by $1.9 million because we're really, that's going to be a cost that we pay, and then we're going to get it back on the back end. In addition to that, we're also looking to get a WQIF grant for this project. Since we're closing the Nassauwattuck plant, DEQ allows now for closure of treatment plants, the discharge of the Chesapeake Bay. Although we're not upgrading the plant, we're eliminating the plant. So they're going to pay us as if we were upgrading the paint plant and put that towards the pipeline project, which is, that's a win-win for everybody, right? We have zero discharge and we're done from Nassauwattuck. So we're, the estimate is about $2.5 million that we hope to get in grant reimbursements on this project. So that could help us to reduce this project budget even further. But that's still under negotiation. We don't have that final number. That's just an estimate. The other thing I was going to mention, cost volatility. So we talked about this issue, right? So the design builder has to give us a price. They gave it to us last July. They've got to pretty much hold that price until now. Historically, we've said, that's on you, Mr. Contractor. You take that risk, which is fine in an economy where the interest rates and the volatility and costs aren't excessive. But if you ask them to give us a price last July and they knew things were starting to bounce around, they're going to put a big contingency on their price. And we really don't want them to put an excess contingency on their price. The other thing is they could put in a low price and then hit us with maybe a force majeure letter saying, well, we couldn't have anticipated that, war in Ukraine. How could anybody anticipate these types of things? We want extra money. So we don't want them putting that on us either. So what we've done on this project, and we're doing on some of the other design build projects, is the biggest price commodity on this project is HDP pipe, 20 plus miles of plastic pipe. They had to give us a price at the time that they gave us that initial budget back in July. They had to give us a quote. And now they give us a new quote as of today. and we look at that quote. And if it's different by more than like 5%, we share the difference in the cost with the design build team. So say it was more than 5%, say it was 15%. Well, we would share the difference between the 15% and the 5% with the design build team for those extra costs that they couldn't have reasonably anticipated going beyond that level of cost. Well, on this project, HDP pipe hadn't moved a lot since last July. So that was kind of what you'd say, well, why did we, that doesn't really matter. But that helps us a lot because they didn't put in a premium for that volatility in their original price. So in this project, we didn't have to pay extra because the quote that came in for the HDP was in that range. Now in 6 months, who knows what's going to happen, but they're going to get those orders in hopefully very soon and be able to lock in on that price. So I think this is a good way of risk sharing the costs in this kind of economy where things are kind of just crazy and bouncing all over the place. We share that risk with the contractor, and I think they appreciate that. And we don't pay a premium up front for them trying to guess what's going to happen 6 months or a year from now. So. On the schedule, if we issue this, allow them to start with the next phase of the project as of this meeting today, they'll begin work in April, and they're very anxious to get started out there. They need to finish their design and start on their construction efforts, and that'll begin hopefully in April and run through June of 2023. We're still working on some of the easements, many of the easement acquisitions, and I'll get a slide on that in a second. We're kind of just running ahead of them. There's 20 miles of pipe, so hopefully there's plenty of work they can work on while we're still working through some of these agreements and easements, and with a goal and the target of finishing in September of 2023 with the project. So aggressive schedule with lots of things still to work through, but I think we've got a good team and they're understanding the challenges we're facing moving forward. So there's a number of property acquisitions that are required. Here's just kind of a laundry list. Some of them are free fee simple, where we're actually, these pump station sites, we want to own the underlying property for those pump station sites. There's one in Assawatics. Obviously, we're turning the treatment plant into a pump station. Exmoor, we've got two fee simple parcels that we have to acquire. The pump station will sit on actually two parcels of land there. Accomack County, we've got a number of parcels that we're dealing with there. There's a number of easements, 20 to 25 easements along the pipeline route. And we're still trying to work out the final details with Canoni on that agreement to go down the railroad right of way with that. We're getting pretty close. We've been working on that for quite a while now, and we're hopeful to have that in the next month. So that's kind of a continuous process that we're working through.
Bruce, how much of these acquisitions are from public versus private?
So the Canoni is pseudo-private, pseudo-public. It's a kind of a deep-pump railroad, and so we're not going to pay for that agreement. There's a number of other parcels, easements, that we're going to probably pay to be with this transmission force main on. Much of the fee simple, some of them we're going to pay for. I believe in Exmoor, we're not. So it just kind of depends on where we are. And I mentioned before, unrelated to this project, we're going to take over the collection system in Onancock. But before we do that, they have six pump stations, and we've required that all those six pump stations, that we acquire all those parcels, and that the town work with us to get that land before we'll actually take ownership of the collection system in Onancock. So it's kind of a mixed bag. There's some of these easements that we'll probably be paying for with private citizens, but most of this easement and property acquisition is in the public hand. We hope to get them for free or very low price. What we're paying on the Eastern Shore isn't what we pay on Jefferson Avenue or Virginia Beach Boulevard for these easements. So the cost is nominal. It's more the time is the issue than the cost. So the recommendation that's in the agenda item is to appropriate additional funding at $8.8 million and approve a stipulated price agreement with Kearney of $22.9 million to move this project forward. So if there's any specific questions, I'll gladly answer them. I've got Charles Bott, who's here, Phil Hubbard, who's been managing this project for us, from HRSD. If there's any real specific detailed questions, I'd glad to answer them now. Thank you for your time.
It's a major undertaking that's really been accomplished in a fairly short period of time. Well done.
Got a good team working with us.
One thing I did want to mention is
It's not in the funding because it's not nothing set in stone, but we have been lobbying DEQ for some of the ARPA money. So in part of when the federal government gave the states guidance on how they can use the money, 50%, 49% I think is supposed to be allocated for disadvantaged communities. And so DEQ is really on board with HRSD being on the Eastern Shore, helping the Eastern Shore out. But typically HRSD has not qualified for this money because by design, our finances are strong, right? And so what we've asked them to do is allow us to qualify for the disadvantaged community money because we're a regional entity, we're trying to help these disadvantaged communities, allow us to qualify for where we're gonna be spending the money. So hopefully we'll be able to get some of this, but they're still trying to work out what's the methodology and how they split the money out, but definitely Eastern Shore is one of their priorities. So we're still gonna be working on that.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Need a motion?
Thank you.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Blend.
Yes.
Lakdawalla.
Yes.
Levinstrom.
Yes.
Stern.
Yes.
Tarosky.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Ellison.
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Item four.
Agenda item number four. This is the James River Treatment Plant bypass conversion emergency. We've got two recommended actions today. One is approve a new CIP project for the James River Treatment Plant bypass conversion and appropriate total project funding in the amount of $5 million. And so MIFAS was presented by Mike Parsons and Stephanie Klaus in August of 2021. It's moving media integrated fixed film activated sludge.
Yeah, right.
And it's part of the partial denitrification Anamox process. And it's something that Dr. Bott, he's due for his annual review. So he's gonna be talking about that sometime this summer. So we've installed this at one of the demonstration tanks at James River. And we're confident that it's going to work. And so this project, we're going to install it in 7 more tanks, and it's designed to reduce nitrogen, which is required for Swift, and also to reduce nitrogen to the bay. One of the things I love about this project is I think it's a great example of how we're leveraging our R&D. And so we've got 3 patents associated with this project. One was a patent from 2012. We've got another pending patent. We just filed another non-provisional patent application on March 14th for some of the technology we're going to be using in this project. And so it's going to provide a significant cost savings, not only from an operational perspective, but potentially capital. And so if we find that this works, we might be able to remove some tanks at the management design and incorporate this technology at that plant as well. So one of the reasons why it's an emergency project is we want our design builder that's doing the giant James River Swift project to be focused. We're getting close to stipulated price on that project. And so this is a relatively small project that our contractor can just get in and out really quickly before the other contractor starts. So.
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Commissioner Rodriguez.
Tarosky, second.
Thank you.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Blend?
Yes.
Lakdawalla?
Yes.
Levinstrom?
Yes.
Stern?
Yes.
Tarosky?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Ellison?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Item 5.
Agenda item 5. This is the Western Branch Sewer System Gravity Improvements for the initial appropriation. The recommended action today is appropriate total project funding in the amount of $5.1 million. And this is to replace about a mile worth of gravity pipeline and manholes. This is a required project by the phase 2 of our rehab action plan. It has to be done by May of 2025. And one of the things I found as reviewing this agenda item that I want to do in the future is add maps. Because, you know, even though I've been here 16 years, I don't know where the Western Ridge exactly is, gravity sewer, where this is. And so we're going to be showing maps for projects like this in the future. And so this project is in Portsmouth. It's along Cedar Lane and Deep Lane, just west of, I think, Lily Creek.
Okay. Move for approval. Blend.
Thank you.
Second, Levinstrom.
Thank you.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Blend.
Yes.
Lakdawalla.
Yes.
Levinstrom.
Yes.
Stern.
Yes.
Tarosky.
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Ellison?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Item six.
Item six, this is the Jefferson Avenue Interceptor Force Main Replacement Phase 3. This is the acquisition resolution. So the recommended action today is adopt the resolution approving the public use determination and directing acquisition by condemnation or by other means of permanent and temporary easements as required for this project. As you recall, we had a public hearing for this project and the project after this. And this one is located in Newport News near Patrick Henry Mall. No speakers or public comment was provided. And we think that some of these properties may need condemnation, but we'll continue to work with these property owners and use condemnation as a last resort. But again, this resolution is the determination of the public need.
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. Thank you both.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. By roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Dr. Wallace?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Stern?
Yes.
Tarosky?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Ellison?
Yes. Motion carries. Item seven.
Item seven, this is a York River isolation valve replacement project acquisition resolution. Similar to the previous agenda item, the recommended action today is adopt the resolution approving the public use determination and directing acquisition by condemnation or other means of permanent and temporary easements as required for the York River isolation valve replacement project. And so this is a series of valves that's going to be required for our Coliseum PRS and TAP PRS. We had the public hearing for this last week. No speakers or public comments were provided. We do think that there may be one of these properties that we may need to condemn as they're not being responsive to any of our contacts to them, our certified mail or anything like that. But again, we'll continue to work with them best we can and use condemnation as last resort.
For approval,
Glenn. Thank you.
All in favor say yes. Those opposed say no. Roll call.
Glenn?
Yes.
Lakdawalla?
Yes.
Levinston?
Yes.
Stern?
Yes.
Tarosky?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Ellison?
Yes. Motion carries. Item eight.
Item eight, this is our monthly COVID-19 wastewater surveillance. And today, we have a special treat. We have JB Mitchell presenting the COVID update today.
Hi, good morning. I know it's unusual for me to be here instead of Raul Gonzalez or Kyle Curtis, but they are both away at a public health and water conference and wastewater disease surveillance summit out in Ohio. So I'm sure they'll be bringing back some valuable information, and I'm sure they're going to be sharing valuable information with other people in the industry and within the health districts. So I do want to note before we jump in that this has been 2 years, more than 2 years at this point, of uninterrupted weekly monitoring. So we have more than 104 weeks of monitoring for COVID-19 in the wastewater. So it's pretty monumental. It represents a lot of work, both by our field staff and our analytical staff. So I just want to acknowledge that they have been able to really successfully get out there and keep that monitoring so that we can have an understanding of the prevalence of disease within our community. And that would be independent, of course, of the clinical testing. So next slide, please. So they were able to update the slides through the data available through the end of last week. So data through March 14th is going to be presented. You will note on the upcoming slides that this will be the first time that the regional viral load has increased since January 10th, but that is largely attributed to what's going on at one facility, and that would be the Atlantic Treatment Plant. The other six facilities all had lower loading rates. One facility, we do need to double check those numbers, rerun that analysis. So Williamsburg needs to have the analysis rerun. Next slide, please. So this is the spatial wastewater loading. As I mentioned, Williamsburg needs to be rerun, but that other great area on the southern part of the peninsula represents Boat Harbor and James River, and those facilities both had non-detect loading. So that's a great thing. And as I mentioned, there are other facilities except for Atlantic all had reduced wastewater loadings this week. Atlantic Plant represents about a quarter of our population. And so that's why on the next slide, you're going to see a little bit of a jump in that regional wastewater loading. And that really is driven by what we see going on in Atlantic, because a little bit of a bump up in Atlantic really driving that loading. The other thing I want to mention here, as we're looking at the clinical case studies on that bottom graph versus the wastewater loading on the top, is that the clinical testing data is probably not as accurate as it used to be. You may recall that as Omicron really started to spread through our population and our incident rates started to increase, is that there wasn't a lot of testing available, or people were doing at-home testing. That just doesn't get reported. So there's going to be a lag or a lack of accuracy associated with this clinical testing data. So really what's going to start becoming more important is really hospitalization and mortality rates as we move forward. And of course, that wastewater surveillance data really gets you a great idea and an accurate depiction of what's going on in your community, because you can't hide from the wastewater. So we were able to really understand what's going on in our community with that regional wastewater collection. Next slide, please. So this slide, as you recall, we started doing the Omicron BA1 variant testing back in early December. And you can see very quickly, as we got through the third week of December, BA1 represented about 50% of the wastewater loading, but just went another week, it quickly overcame Delta and really started becoming the prevalent strain at 100%, or roughly 100% of our wastewater loading. So we are adding in the BA2 variant testing. We don't have that ready yet, but it will be ready to go shortly. And certainly by the next time that Raul or Kyle present, you'll be able to hear a little bit more about what's going on with BA2. What we suspect is that as soon as BA2 really starts to get hold, you're going to see an increase much like this, where BA2 will quickly become the dominant strain, because we understand that it to be more transmissible than BA1. Next slide, please. So what we have going forward, I already mentioned that we're going to jump into the BA2 testing. We did hit that milestone of 2 years, which we're pretty excited about. The other thing that we're excited about is that Raul has been selected as a committee member for the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine for a special committee on wastewater-based infectious disease surveillance. And so that committee is going to be looking at the potential value toward prevention and control of infectious diseases in the United States by using this wastewater surveillance as a tool. So we're pretty excited about that he's representing. It looked like he was the only utility member on that group of a dozen members in that committee. And we also have another Virginia representative, that would be Rekha Singh. She's with the Virginia Department of Health, and she's the one that's managing the Virginia Department of Health's Sentinel Surveillance Monitoring System. And so we'll be well represented with the state of Virginia on this committee. So we're excited about that. Raul also wanted me to note that CDC is moving forward with a paper that's using Virginia Beach as a case study and looking at the number of infected individuals using that wastewater surveillance data. So that's another thing that's coming up. Environment Virginia Symposium is next week, and that's held in Lexington. There's a whole session dedicated to wastewater surveillance. Virginia Department of Health will be presenting first to talk about their Sentinel surveillance system across the state. HRSD, the local health district, and the city of Chesapeake will be presenting to talk about that locality scale regional monitoring that you heard about in December. And then the University of Virginia will be there to talk a little bit more about monitoring at the building scale. So it's a nice tie-in going from statewide monitoring to locality monitoring to building scale monitoring. So we're excited about that. I did want to mention, I don't have a slide for it, but Jay had asked that we discuss a little bit more about the CDC National Wastewater Surveillance Monitoring Network. Kyle presented a slide on it last month, but I just wanted to touch base on that and its linkage with the Virginia Department of Health Sentinel Surveillance. So in early summer of 2020, CDC did reach out to us, and we engaged in conversation with them about best practices with wastewater surveillance monitoring. And we were able to gather a lot of information from utilities, from other health districts across the country, and they were able to launch a national wastewater surveillance program in September of 2020. They have a dashboard that identifies the wastewater loading and the trends within the country on their website. And I think that Kyle provided that link last month. But I wanted to talk about how the two things are linked with the Virginia Department of Health and the CDC. So the Virginia Department of Health, their Sentinel program includes Virginia Initiative Plan, includes Nansemond, Onancock, Williamsburg, and Atlantic Plan. And so that is all loaded up. We provide them with weekly monitoring. We've been doing that since the fall of 2021. And that dashboard should go live any day now. The CDC dashboard and the CDC has been gathering the information from those facilities because the Virginia Department of Health provides them with that input. But then the CDC also reached out to us recently and offered us to be included in some grant opportunity where we now also submit for Boat Harbor, James River, York River, and Army Base. Those samples go to a CDC contract lab, and that data gets submitted to the National Wastewater Surveillance Network so that it'll show up on the dashboard as well. So at this point, we have all of our majors in Onancock either covered through the state's Sentinel Monitoring Program or through the CDC's National Monitoring Program. And I think that's all that I had that was important. I have a couple of notes. One of the things that certainly interests us is the future of monitoring once COVID-19 perhaps is not as critical. And I think just in terms of general infectious disease monitoring, I think it'll be important. There are also some significant interest in antimicrobial resistance monitoring using wastewater surveillance for that. Of course, we've talked about the opioid epidemic and using it to monitor for those potential opioid use or any other type of illicit drug use. And then there's also conversation about using it as general markers for population health and perhaps even linking it to environmental justice. There's a lot of ethics to consider, and that's actually what this National Academy of Science committee is also going to consider, is the ethics of some of this monitoring. Because you might be able to monitor for, say, colon cancer genetic markers, but you know what are the ethics and what are the constraints around that you need to consider so that you don't invade the privacy of local community members. And I think that's the last slide. If there are any questions, I'll do my best to answer those.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, so for joining science, going to be reaching out to our communities as we figure out how to use it and monitor privacy or allow privacy.
Yeah, and that's going to be a really interesting thing. One of the items on that environmental justice piece that I find interesting, and this is very early in development, as I mentioned, there's a lot of the ethicists are going to have to weigh in. But EPA reached out to Raul to talk about the possibility of using some of these cancer markers to identify communities that are more impacted by potential environmental conditions than others. And so that's just one example. It's really an exciting frontier, and I'm fascinated to see where it goes. And, you know, you got to keep in mind that patient privacy and it'll be interesting.
Very much. Well, thank you. Okay, we're going on to unfinished business. Any?
Not that I know.
All right. New business. Anyone? Commissioner comments.
Great person. Yes.
It's like a huge team brings us together.
Public comments. We don't have any registered,
yes,
and information items that were at the end of the report. Any questions? Okay, thank you. We are ready to move into a work session dealing with the 2023 annual budget. Do you want to take a short break? Okay. How long are you going to be going?
Maybe 20-ish minutes.
Okay. They're about half hour, let's say. So we'll take a, let's see, what is it? It's 8:00. How about a little later than 10 after? our work session going over the 2023 annual budget.
All right, good morning again. Yeah. This is, as you know, this is my favorite time of year. So it's actually super
special. What you be doing it next year?
Yeah, I know, but I mean, how awesome is it like to be the GM, but also to do the budget? I mean, to me, it's like just mind blowing. I just love this stuff. Good. And you may not love the numbers today, but I'll try to present it to make it fun. So again, I just wanted to give you bottom line up front, kind of like, what's going on, and then go into details on the revenues and expenses. So bottom line up front, I've not had to use these icons before, so you'll have to bear with me. So the first one's chemicals, 44%. So, you know, I kind of, you know, said earlier that sodium hydroxide was up 60%, but overall chemicals are up 44%. This is my attempt at utilities, it's up 22%. And so maybe if Anne was here, we could ask her about what natural gas is doing. But, you know, we're projecting 22%. And then hospitalization up 7.9% last year, was up 8%. And again, we talked about this idea of personnel capitalization. That's where we're moving folks from engineering and a few folks from operations to be paid for this by the capital program. And then we can capitalize that. So it's about $3.6 million. In terms of the rate increase, we talked about that 9.1% rate increase. That equates up to about 11 cents a day increase for our customers. You can't see this, and it's, maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, but it's, OPEX is up 5.7%, which is, we started at over 10%, and we were able to whittle down, so we're at 5.7%. In terms of our financial plan, though, it's up about 2.5% higher than our financial plan, but then that's going to be offset by higher than expected revenue. So even though it's a higher OPEX number, water consumption kind of saves the day a little bit in this budget season. So we'll talk about that. Just a quick update. You might have seen this in the monthly report, but a huge kudos to Jill Morrison in customer care in IT. And we distributed $10.3 million to 59,000 accounts. And so if you saw in the monthly reports, this is just the 90-day plus, what a huge dent that made in our arrearage. And this was so much more impactful than the first round of CARES money, because in that first round, folks had to attest that they were impacted by COVID. And so you would be surprised how many people didn't want to do the simple attestation. And so when the Commonwealth came up with the second round of this money through ARPA and divvied that out, they came up with a way where we didn't have to get the attestation. And so that's why it was such a big IT project. So we found all the folks in arrearage in the simplified way. We clicked a button, it applied it to their accounts, and that's how we helped 59,000 customers. So we did have a little bit of extra money. So we helped localities with their accounts for about $200,000. And you know, another great thing about this, and the reason why you don't see a straight $10 million down, is we were actually able to apply this to written off accounts. We weren't able to do that in round one. And you think about written off accounts, that's when we never thought we'd ever be able to get. And so that was a little over $1 million-ish that we were able to get. So we're only able to utilize 96%. So we are going to have to send back 400,000, which isn't bad, because when we talked to some of the localities, they were having to give back. I mean, they were only able to utilize 80%. So being at 96%, especially with such a big number like this, like we were probably one of the largest recipients, it is great. And it's just been a huge lift by our folks. So great effort to them. Huge kudos to them.
That was a great, great effort in a very short period of time.
Yeah, definitely.
Time constraint was enormous.
So we've been able to use all the money we could possibly use for whatever allowable reasons we could use it.
Oh yeah, trust me. We're like, what else can we use this for? Like, call the localities. Do you need any more money? So we really, because the first round we used it all up. And then like we really did not want to have to give any back. So we tried like everything, but that's the best we could do. So huge effort,
just,
though.
Were we just a little more prepared for the second round? I mean, we knew what to do based on the first round.
Yeah, it was a combination of that, but we're also kind of hamstrung by how the Commonwealth wrote it. So they said you could only apply it up through August 31st. but we didn't apply until like February. So there's probably more arrears that we could have applied if they're a little bit more flexible with the time frame. But because they stopped it and people didn't know this money was coming, they might have started paying their bills. And so the money we thought that we needed was going down. So that's kind of why a lot of localities ended up at like 80%, is because people, they started their collection system, they started tagging and shutting off, and people started paying their bills. So that was, there's a lot of dynamics with that. But still, I mean, to help many customer accounts, that's pretty big. That's maybe 15%, 10 to 15% of our total accounts. So really good news there. So on the revenue side, one of the things I always want to highlight is the importance of water consumption. So if you look at our revenue streams, almost 95% is based on water consumption. Our second highest revenue line item at only 1.8% is facility charges, and we'll talk about that in a second. So if you think about the revenue, remember the equation. It's the water consumption, the amount of that folks use times the rate. So we're doing that 9.1 rate increase, but we're really at the mercy of what customer human behavior is in terms of water consumption. And so looking at the trend, you saw in fiscal year 21, we had a huge jump at 3.2%. That's like I have not seen that in any of the record, a big jump like that. So to me, it's suspect, right? I think it's like an anomaly. So the last time we had a little bit of a bump, it came straight back down. And so as I'm projecting for water consumption, I'm just going to assume conservatively that it's going to be flat year over year. So I'm not assuming a decrease. I don't know what's going on with pandemic water uses, and we've got some folks looking at the data. But really, this is, I'm a little bit of a suspect of that one. Like, one data point does not make a trend, right? So we'll see. Hopefully, we'll see what happens at the end of this year. Right now, we're tracking similar to 21. But again, trying to be conservative in our budget and not overestimate.
Is there a correlation with anything else out there? Any other utilities? Any other?
So the problem with any other utilities is that their industrial base is so much larger than us. And so they get way more impacted. And so unless, I haven't seen any of them do a study like we're trying to do now, is we're trying to isolate just the residential component of workflow. And that's not out yet in terms of he's cranking through the numbers, analyzing it. But there's definitely a pandemic component to that bump for sure. And I don't know if it's, you know, originally we were thinking it's folks coming from the big cities, moving into the suburbs, which is driving the housing market, but then people working from home, are they using more water at home? So there's all kinds of stuff. And I think I told you all about our internal folks did a study where more folks, instead of taking a shower in the morning, they take a shower at lunchtime. They saw that diurnal curve kind of shift. So more to come on that. Again, like I was a little bit, I'm being conservative on what our budget should be on this. So again, this is our proposed rate increase. If you look at the total wastewater bill, if you look at how much folks typically pay for their collection side, total bills will be about $69, which is about 1% of median household income. And again, what we tell folks is, why is our rate increasing? It's because our capital improvement program, and 87% of it is regulatory required. I mentioned this a second ago, like our second biggest revenue line item is still only 1.8% of total revenue. And so we're assuming that it's relatively flat, maybe down 170,000. If you look at the single family housing permits from Hampton Roads Planning District Commission, you can see things kind of flat now. Could be due to a number of factors. You know, you got mortgage rates rising, you got labor and supply shortages. But you know, another data point is mortgage applications are at its lowest in 2 years. And it could be driven by lack of housing supply, you know, higher mortgage rates. So we're just gonna assume flat year over year facility charges. So any questions on revenues before I jump to expenses? Cool. All right, so I'm gonna try something new this year, right? So I'm trying to hit the ground running as a general manager. And one of the things we can't do in my first month of office is have a strategic plan, right? But what I want to do is try to illustrate what I want our strategic plan to do, what my vision for how it's going to be implemented and how I want it to flow through the budget, because I'm a very goal-oriented person. And so my vision is that when you have a plan, from the plan, you're going to establish goals. And the way to accomplish those goals is typically through the budget, right? And so what I want to do is start to present the budget in a different way that's more aligned with the strategic plan. And since we don't have a strategic plan, I just want to illustrate this. And so what I did was I took someone else's strategic plan and had universal concepts and overlay what some of our budget items are. So hopefully that makes sense. It's really just an illustrative process of what I want to try to do. Because I'm like a visual person, I like to see it, it helps me understand it. And so this is our current strategic plan. And again, there's no real tie to our budget, to our strategic plan, and that's what I want to change. So assume that our strategic plan, in one of those bubbles, it, like maybe people, is customers and community. And so that's a key budget priority for us, customers and community. And so in the blue, this would be our goal. Our goal is to provide exceptional customer service and maintain an excellent reputation in the community. And so in the budget, how we're going to achieve that goal is, and so these are kind of the big things that I borrowed, but just kind of conceptually what I'm trying to illustrate. But these are actually things that are actually in this budget. So one of the things I talked to Layla Rice about is developing this 5-year brand strategy and potentially changing our name. Because one of the things I talked to you all about before was, I think the biggest risk to HRSD is a rate revolt. And so rates are going to continue to increase and probably double in the next 10 years. And so if our customers don't see a value in the monthly bill that they pay or bi-monthly bill that they pay, they're going to say, why do you keep raising my rates? I'm not seeing any value in this. And so one of the things we're going to try to do is create a brand strategy over 5 years, because it's going to take time. There's also money in the budget for a customer bill redesign to help people understand their bills better. We're also going to add a public information specialist. Also, we're going to do a new call center system. One of the things we learned in the ransomware was that we couldn't easily change any of the voice prompts in the call center system. It like took IT and it was just very, very difficult. And so it's an old call center system. So we've got budgeted to replace that. And so even though this is already in the fiscal year 22 budget, just another couple of items that kind of go to how we're gonna achieve this goal is we're doing this Fiserv walk-in payments. And so people are gonna be able to pay at Walmart, Kroger, and Farmfresh in different areas and not have to come to our building here. They'll have different options. We're also gonna add a kiosk, kind of like a little ATM machine right out on the corner where people can come and pay their bills. So more options for our customers. Again, let's say the key budget priority is fiscal responsibility, which I love, probably being a very important thing. So the goal would be to manage finances wisely and prudently. One of the things we've done already, we've refocused, we've created this division of capital finance. This is gonna be Aaron Girardi's group. One of the things we're proposing is a new business process engineer. And that's like an engineer with an MBA, right? So I think we found return on investment with engineers that have MBAs, like look at Chesley's, we're saving $239 million. And so how can we formalize this business case analysis process, develop the SOPs, standardized assumptions, and really, because like right now it's kind of being done as a side job for different people, but we really kind of want to centralize that and make that standardized across the organization. And I think it's time, with all the federal money out there, that we have a grants writer or grants administrator. We have a, and this is kind of born out of our internal auditor, SCNH. They're in the middle of doing an audit of all of our grants. We've got grants called probably almost in every department. So we wanna do is centralize that, have someone that can be focused, that has the skill set, because I know it's a very unique skill set. Like no one that I know internally has that unique skill set that knows how to grant, write grants, because Aaron and I missed on a couple for sure for climate change, for different things. And so there's money out there. So I think significant ROI if we can get a grants writer that can take advantage of that.
So you would have a person who would have, I guess, answer to you, but then still keep the individuals in the first department, wherever else departments, still there and just coordinate with the grant?
Yeah, because there's all kinds of grants. So like in Dr. Botshop, he does grants with universities and they do lots of partnerships across, and maybe he could just keep that himself, but then he needs help with invoicing and things like that. So this person would help facilitate. And so that's why I was saying, like, when we found out how complicated it was, and it's been different in every little group, we just kind of need to centralize that and have someone focused and responsible for all of that.
So just not acquiring grants, but also administering grants.
Both, yeah. So this person would have that skills. Hopefully, does that person exist?
I actually, from what I years ago, I worked for New Jersey Institute of Technology. So when you work at a research university, you do have a centralized office. And ODU has it also. And so it helps ease the burden of the individual researcher making sure they're in compliance.
Yeah.
That's what comes down to so often is compliance or an auditing process. And so yeah. Just follow the model of what OPU uses or University of Virginia. That works out really, really well.
And then the last thing on this, on the fiscal responsibility, is we're adding a new data analyst. And one of the, right now, the data analysis section really focuses on flow and engineering stuff, but they have so much potential. They are really good with pivot tables and Power BI. We can mine the data in our ERP system, look for nuggets of information, you know, turn that data into insight, into good decision making. So again, I love this Slack because there's all kinds of my ideas like on how we're going to improve our fiscal, where we are. And then on workforce development, key priority, recruit, empower, and engage in a highly trained and diverse workforce. And so one of the things we're trying to do is in talent management, have someone focused on talent acquisition. So they right now, the way they're structured is they kind of do it, everybody does a little bit of everything. But what we want is someone that's really focused on workforce development. And we talked about this during my interview is the HBCU intern program. So we're piloting that with our electrical engineering folks. And then we also in talent management, we're proposing for 6 summer interns, youth interns. It's a partnership with WHRO and the HR workforce. And this is really targeted towards these underrepresented communities. And what's interesting is they'll get a year credit of HRSD apprenticeship going through this program if they want to continue to work for HRSD. So really cool program that we're going to be doing in the next fiscal year. But again, these are the things we're going to invest in to achieve that goal. And this is kind of my last example is environmental stewardship. And so in the water quality section, we've got some money for research. Probably the biggest one is PFAS. And we talk about this at our capital improvement program meeting is that PFAS is probably the highest risk for us in terms of future regulations. Probably more so in biosolids, but also potentially in SWIFT. Okay, so hopefully that makes sense how I want to align those strategic plans with goals and roll that into the budget. So I'm presenting the budget in a way that, again, is in alignment. So where are we budgeting operating expenses? Again, I highlighted it in blue. It's our people, salaries and benefits. That's about 48% of our operating expenses. And so I'm going to provide you this spreadsheet like I always do every year. Full transparency to the commission. You'll see line item detail. One of the things that you'll see is how we ended up at 5.7%. And we're going to talk about some of the big numbers, like some of these big percent numbers on the increase in what the trend is. One of the things to note is like on the people trend, it's only up 0.8%, and you're going to see how many people we're adding. And I'll tell you why that it's only up 0.8% on a year-over-year basis. So again, we're only up 0.8% on a year-over-year basis, but we're proposing 30 new positions. These positions highlighted in blue are the ones that are going to go move into the capital improvement program. Again, in finance, we talked about some of these, but in operations, one of the things we want to do is I feel like we're stretched so thin. We're just taking over the Eastern Shore. We need to add the resources to take on those additional responsibilities. So we're proposing a new chief of small communities. This was a chief that was always at HRSD and took care of the Middle Peninsula, but we got rid of it. But I think it's time to bring it back because there's so much going on with Eastern Shore, so much going on with these small communities. We really need someone to really just make sure that and they stay on top of all of that. So this lead operator, maintenance operators, 5 of these maintenance operators, it's going to be this maintenance team that's going to be starting up different facilities around the district. And then a big investment in electrical and instrumentation, that's what E&I is. As our plants get more sophisticated, there's lots more instrumentation going on and automation. And so we need to continue to invest in that because it's only going to grow, particularly when those Swift plants come online. I mean, most of the water plants are very automated and require lots of instrumentation. So we need to start investing in that. And then in information technology, we used to have a chief of IT. We're going to bring it back. We're going to try to hire a Unix system person if we can find one. And again, investment in cybersecurity. So this is the personnel capitalization. These are the folks. We've got 5 new folks in engineering and 16 existing in engineering moving to be paid in the capital program. And in operations, they've got 4 existing folks that are going to move into the capital program. So this is something I wanted to highlight in terms of the utilities trend, because it's not like it's being driven by additional usage, new plants or anything. And so you can see what the impact of R&D. So in the gray bars, you can see a steady trend up. And then Dr. Bott started the research and development department. And then you can see it's been relatively flat. And then you see like in fiscal year 22 budget, this big bump. But really you can see how flat, and these are CAFR numbers, these are actual numbers on how flat utilities have been. We started up nutrient plants in fiscal year 2011. Fiscal year 17 was another nutrient deadline and more nutrient plants started up, which used a lot more power, blowers, aerators. But then you see this kind of like this anomaly in this fiscal year 22 budget. But again, kudos to R&D in that investment and the things that they've been doing to keep utilities flat. And chemicals is probably even more striking. So this is like what we talked about earlier about the PDNA and the MIFAS and that kind of patented technologies. It does this, you know, it really flattens out. Look at this decline in chemicals. And again, fiscal year 11, fiscal year 17 were big regulatory deadlines, started up big nutrient plants. And then you see the fiscal year 20, like this anomaly due to inflation on chemicals. But so any questions about that before we jump into hospitalization?
Let me just ask, in terms of us going back, expanding SWIFT, will that increase the use of chemicals or decrease? Just if Charles is on the line, does he see, no, have any idea?
Dr. Brown, are you on? Okay, that's okay, because I can take it. Yes. Lots of chemicals, water plants use less. So the difference between typically, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bruce, that most of the wastewater plants are more biological treatment. Most of the water plants are chemical treatment. So lots more chemicals used on the water plant side. And so we've accounted for that in our financial model. So we were just looking at it yesterday, making sure that when those plants come online, we're accounting for those future costs. So when you look at our debt service coverage, you can see when there's a dip in debt service coverage, essentially that means the SWIFT plant's coming online or issue a new bond. But yeah, definitely chemicals are going to be a big deal for SWIFT.
The flocculation process uses chemicals, and then they have to balance the pH just right before they put it back in the groundwater. So those are two areas where you're going to be using more chemicals. Probably others too.
So is Linda online? She's going to do hospitalization, or I can just do it.
I'm here.
Okay, Linda. I can flip the slides for you, Linda. I'm going to turn it over to Linda Rallop. She's our human resources business partner.
Good morning, everyone. I'm just going to go through a few slides, talk to you a little bit about the health insurance. This first slide that's showing is kind of reflecting on where HRSD lies in relation to our benchmarks. The benchmark information comes from Mercer. You can see in the current year, we have no premiums that we charge our employees. In large part, this is tying back to what Jay has already said, where he wants to emphasize the value that the employees bring and continue to support that in the ways that we have been reflected in how we handle our health insurance. Our co-pays in our pharmacy are kind of running just a slight bit lower than the survey norm. In addition, our deductibles, you can see the 15 and the 3000 for the deductible, and then the out-of-pocket max running 3 and 6. Currently, the IRS minimums on high deductible health plans for deductibles are running at $1,400 and $2,800. So in the not too distant future, unfortunately, we may be forced to take a look at those, but we're kind of staying the course at the moment. Okay, next slide. This slide kind of shows you actual spend for the last few fiscal years from 17 to 21. Giving you from 10.7 million to 11.3, and then reflecting on that, what that means in per employee per month expenditures. You can see we've taken a little bit of a jump this year. That in part has to do with some high dollar claims. Cyclically, this kind of was our year. We don't find it particularly disturbing at this point because we've had several good years where our high dollar claims have kind of matched the norm, but we've had one claim in particular that's kind of driven things up for the current year. We expect that will level back off. Okay, next slide. And this is kind of just reflecting on where the majority of our spend comes from. So chronic conditions are a big one, members on specialty meds, catastrophic cases, which is kind of where that spend for that one high dollar claim is coming from. And then behavioral health conditions as well. One kudo to HRSD and all of our employees, those that are on prescription drugs exceed the market year after year in their usage of generic drugs. At 92%, that's kind of just way out of the norm. So it's a huge cost savings both to the employee in the initial months where the expense goes to them under the deductible, and then it's passed on to HRSD in those later months of the plan year. And then, as would be expected with the way COVID has done things, our telemedicine usage is way up. So 26% of folks have utilized telehealth in this process as well. Okay, next slide. And this kind of goes in, we're not expecting to make any changes to our deductibles or the out-of-pocket expenses this year. We want to continue to kind of focus on our normal cost-saving strategies, educating the employees on how to make the most of their benefits, both when they're paying for it and when the dollar goes to HRSD as well. As Jay has already mentioned to you, there is a $13.6 million increase at a 7.9%. Percentage rate, and again,
it's not it's a 7.9% increase of $1 million year over year.
Yeah, sorry,
Oh, no, you even heard it.
But this again is largely driven by claims that are in that 100 to 250k, and are two times higher than our past three fiscal years. We have one claim in particular that reached 1.1 million. So the top 10 claims are at 32.4% of total spend for medical. So any questions? I believe that's the last slide.
Any questions? So like Inda said, like on terms of hospitalization, we were due. So we had like a great run of like really essentially flat hospitalization, but you know, it only takes a handful of really bad situations to really mess up a fiscal year. So, but, you know, again, one data point doesn't make a trend. So we were probably due. And so we're just going to be conservative and assume a 7.9% increase year over year. So, okay, compensation study. So this is a super hot topic within the organization. Just so you know, it is the hot topic. And so if you recall in our commission adopted policy, we target within 10% of the market 90th percentile. So if someone's making $100,000, we want to at least pay them $90,000. So say $100,000 is the 90th percentile. If we're paying $90,000, that's exactly where we want to be. And so we just redid our study. I think we do it every 3 years. And we did 53 benchmark jobs. All across the organization and all the executives. And one of the things that we asked them about is, well, how are you going to account for wage inflation? And so they use 3.6% aging. So I had to gut check that. So I looked at Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that's about right. So local government is right at around 2.2%. Private sector is right around 4%. So 3.6, it's in the ballpark. But it just looks weird because it's different than like the 8% numbers we're seeing year over year on CPI. So that's why I was like, let me get check that. So I checked that. So that looks like that's a right number. So one of the things that we found in this study is that all jobs are between 7 and 8% lower than the market 90th. And so what that means is we're still within policy, but now, just today. And so one of the things that I've heard already from the Hampton Roads Planning District Commission is like just about every locality, because they're like loaded with ARPA money, they're like giving raises across the board between 4 and 6 and 7%. And so by next year, we'll be out of policy. And so we only do these like every 3 years. And so one of the things we propose is to do something this fiscal year. And so what we'd like to do is to do an overall structural change, and that's what's built into the budget. And so y'all cover your ears. And so, because I want to make sure that when we present this to the organization, that it's presented in a way that has context. And so in the budget, what we're proposing is an across the board 4.4% increase. So in our scale, every step you go up is 4.4%. So what we're proposing is a 4.4% increase to everybody on July 1st. And then for the folks that are within the table, that they still get their merit on their merit date. So in essence, they get 8.8% for fiscal year 23. And then the phase two is, and there's more details into that structural change, but that's kind of the big picture dollar cost that's in the budget. In terms of phase two, each director is going to be tasked with a very job-specific position adjustment. So I know Steve's talked about plant operators, and in every department, they have like a very specific job that needs to be looked at. And so they'll be tasked with doing that for phase two. But the big budget impact is on phase one. And so that's that overall budget increase is the number that's in the budget. And after I start to hear about exactly what each locality passes this fiscal year, I'm almost thinking we probably can't wait 3 years for the next one. We might have to wait only 2 years for the next one, because I don't want us to put in a non-competitive position. I want to make sure we stay within policy. Just with the rate of that the increase, I'm just worried that we might have to do this in 2 years instead of three.
Do you track people leaving their positions or another position solely because of income?
I think so. Hey, Darissa, are you on the phone? I have to phone a friend.
Yes.
Did you hear the question?
Do we track the reasons why people leave the organization? Was that the question?
Yeah, is it due to money?
Do you specifically track?
If they tell us. We do have an exit interview process, but it's completely voluntary. When people send us their resignations, if they do, they normally don't provide us with too much detail. So I would not know whether or not they were leaving for more money.
So maybe they don't fill out a survey or
anything. Mm-hmm.
You don't ask that question.
Yeah, I guess not. Maybe we should.
Yes, it is a question that's asked, but again, the exit interviews are completely voluntary.
I'm just curious. People leave, I believe, because.
Yeah, yeah. Is it their supervisor? Is it money? Because the things I read is that people usually leave because they don't like their boss. That would be a great data point if we could figure out why people are leaving, you know?
Just helps out that down the road.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so if y'all don't have any other questions about the comp policy, these are the next steps. So we've got a finance committee on the 14th, the draft budget on the 26th, and in May, formal budget adoption. So in terms of the finance committee meeting, again, what I want to talk about there is the overall picture. So like what I presented today is really just the operating expenses, but The next budget meeting provides that 5.8 in terms of context of the overall program, in terms of the capital spend, what's our projected debt service coverage ratio, and to ensure that we are within financial policy and that our finances are great. So that's going to be on tap for the 14th. That'll be a detailed presentation in the 26th. Unless there's any questions, we'll whittle that down, give you our debt service coverage forecast, and so we'll be ready for the formal budget adoption in May. So any questions? So one of the things I wanted to make sure I got out of today is, like, do you have any issues with the comp philosophy or the comp policy? Because what I want to get ahead of is the word of mouth. So I want to make sure that they don't get things taken out of context, and that I'm still going to put an asterisk. Commission still has to approve the budget in May. But I'll just going to mention that what I presented and what our proposal is. So.
I think it's good plan. I think it's a good step to maybe review it again in 2 years. What's taking place now?
I'm just surprised. This is the first time I've ever heard of so many localities being in sync on providing raises to their employees. Usually that's so hard for them. Usually maybe do 2%, but to hear fours and sixes from localities, that's pretty rare.
Mm-hmm. You keep up the times. It's real competitive out there.
I'm sure.
And that's why I asked the question about people leaving and leaving for money reasons or other reasons. And it'd be nice to know that and could in the future somehow track that. It kind of keeps you a little bit ahead of the game, knowing what the
things going. You got the inflation, which we're just on the front end of.
Yeah.
But then you have the post-COVID monies that are still sitting in everybody's bank accounts, government type. Bank accounts that they have the ability without having to play with taxes to give these raises.
Yeah, because if they don't spend it, I think by 2024 they have to give it back. So, Commissioner String, you had a question.
I was just going to make a comment in regards to funding and what's going on out there and revenue and how it's utilized, even in the nonprofit world. But investment in employees for retention purposes is a real driving force. So I know that it's going to become more competitive out there. It already is in regards to recruiting very talented people. And that's why I think to your question about tracking, why people leave, and maybe to look at that tracking tool with questions, because I think it would be helpful if it's an opportunity to retain an employee. I don't know what your retention rate is once somebody resigns. If they resign, are they gone? So I'll be interested to meet with folks, you know, during some of my briefings to hear more about this. But I think it's only going to become more challenging. So the more data we can collect and see what trending is. And then, of course, to your point, with reaching out to training schools, institutions, in order to get the talent that we need to condition it, would be really important.
No, great points for your. Okay, that's all I had. If y'all didn't have any other questions.
Well. Oh. We are down to announcements. So we have, as you pointed out there, the next finance committee meeting, which will be going over the budget for 2023, is April 14, 9 a.m. here. And I'm assuming that might be dress casual. Now, the business casual for this group is formal business attire.
No ties.
All right, no ties. No ties. If you want to do the jacket, okay.
Hey, we don't want to wear shoes. Don't wear shoes.
Next formal meeting, regular meeting, monthly meeting, will be in Newport News on April 26th. And again, same. Business casual, no ties. You know, even I would say weather will be turning.
Yep.
Short sleeves. All right.
I'm in.
We are adjourned.
Thank you.
This is the last place I've worked.
Yeah.